Now, Bill Resnick talks with Christian Williams about his take on the case of Trayvon Martin, the Stand Your Ground laws behind it, and how capitalism produces violently insecure individuals like George Zimmerman. Bill?
Christian Williams, welcome to KABU.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Christian Williams is a Portland writer, activist, author, wrote Our Enemies in Blue, a book. He's publishing constant articles on policing and power relations in this country. Really worth reading. Christian Williams, give us a brief rundown of the Trayvon Martin case and Zimmerman who shot him. What happened?
The story is almost appallingly straightforward. I mean, Trayvon Martin, his black teenager, was coming home from the store where he was buying iced tea and Skittles, and a white neighbor saw him, thought that he was suspicious, called 911 to report it, started following him despite the fact that the 911 dispatcher told him not to. Eventually caught up with him. Zimmerman says that Martin then attacked him, but whatever happened next, at the end of it, Zimmerman shot Martin and killed him. The police then have declined to arrest or prosecute Zimmerman, saying that they don't have any evidence that he wasn't defending himself. So, you know, the story here is basically that a white guy saw this black kid, thought prima facie that he was suspicious. It seems like based only on the fact that he was a young black man.
Wearing a hoodie, of course.
And therefore shot and killed him. And the criminal justice system looks at this with its always neutral and objective eye and decides that, you know, obviously the white man was defending himself in this case.
And that could have been the end of it, except that...
Well, except that there's been a huge public outcry.
It took a long time before it developed, though. It wasn't as if it took a lot of effort by family and other people who are appalled by this vigilantism,
shooting
of young people, particularly by police.
I mean, really, the family was agitating about it. There were a handful of black journalists around the country who were really trying to keep the story alive in the weeks following. And then the thing that made it really come through as national news was the release of the 911 tapes, where you hear how Zimmerman describes Martin, and you hear the pure vagueness of his judgment that anything suspicious is happening at all. And then you hear the terrible screaming in the background when Martin is actually killed. And that audio clip really brought it into public focus in a national way.
Yeah, and then there was a lot more investigation, both of Zimmerman's background and his mania, apparently, for security and his fear of intruders or whatever it is into his gated community.
Yeah, I mean, I forget exactly how many times it was, but Zimmerman had called 911 dozens of times in the previous month, reporting, you know, equally vague sort of suspicious activity. I mean, it's terribly tragic.
It appears now there are sort of independent investigations. I'd be surprised if the Justice Department didn't do something about it. What's amazing to me is the immense amount of support that Zimmerman is getting from various sort of right-wing types.
Well,
it's shocking, actually.
You know, his action fits into the whole sort of law and order kind of narrative, and it appeals to people who imagine themselves to be besieged in some way. The sort of race-neutral way of putting it is like, you know, criminals or miscreants or whatever, but, you know, what they really mean is people of color, who they read as being inherently dangerous or like embodying disorder.
Yeah, amongst a lot of people, so many people are personalizing their insecurity and fears and anger and attributing it all somehow to these easy targets, these feared, whatever their major fear is, whether they're racist or whether they're just sort of class-based. Racism, of course, is so endemic that young black men are the major victims. They decide that young black men or others are the cause of all of the insecurity and fear that they're facing. Well, let's talk about the law that has gotten a lot of attention as, in fact, in some ways facilitating these crimes. What do you make of that argument?
Well,
the Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah, a lot of attention has been brought to this Stand Your Ground law. And I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't read the legal code. My understanding of what the law says is that in order to legally defend yourself, you don't have a responsibility to exhaust other possibilities first. So you don't have to try to talk the person down or try to run away or anything like that, that you have a right to resist violence with violence without having to exhaust nonviolent options. The reason that this law came up is because the police cited it as giving the benefit of the doubt to Zimmerman, such that because he claimed that he was defending himself and because they could not show that he wasn't, that he was just standing his ground. As a story, I don't think that has a lot going for it, partly because this armed man followed and stalked and then shot and killed this unarmed person. I mean, it's fairly clear who the aggressor was in this situation, even according to the story that Zimmerman told. I mean, if it seems like anybody was standing their ground, it would be, you know, or if it would have a right to stand their ground, it would have been Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. So on its whole, I'm not sure how much that law, it makes sense to invoke that law in Zimmerman's defense. The fact that they have has then led people to direct their criticism toward the law and say, oh, well, we need to change this law because it allows this kind of thing to happen. I think that's also kind of a mistake because I'm not convinced that the outcome here would have been substantially different were the standards around self-defense or, you know, the laws around assault or whatever, were they different? The history of law enforcement, especially in the South, accommodating and encouraging individual or informal group action to maintain the racial hierarchy is really deep. It goes back all the way to colonial times. And I think that the bias is really in the application of the law and in the enforcement of the law. So I don't know that changing the law is actually the right approach here. It seems like there's the problem is actually much, much deeper than that.
This is Cable Radio. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole, talking to Christian Williams, Portland writer, activist, author of the book Our Enemies in Blue, about the Trayvon Martin case. We've just talked about the role of that Stand Your Ground law. I have a somewhat different view, complementary. It seems to me the law does facilitate more of that sort of conduct. It tells people that you're under attack all the time and the attack is coming from the outside, from these people. That's implicit in it. So it sort of reinforces all of those views. Secondly, it says you have the right to actually get really aggressive. You don't have to back off. You don't have to take this anymore. You can mm-hmm. shoot. And that seems to me to have an impact, particularly on a number of things. One of them is on crazy people who sort of think that now I'm going to be able to really go at these people somehow. Secondly, it seems to have an impact on what you suggested, vigilante groups, and it gives them license to get out there with guns. It's part of that whole system of arming yourself and protecting your borders or your neighborhood or whatever the right. vigilantes are protecting.
The law definitely does play into this larger racialized narrative about crime, and it takes for granted, you know, who it is who's going to be, you know, making the stand and who the aggressors are going to be. And I think that larger narrative, I mean, I think the law was probably, given the way law and order politics play out, that racially coded message was probably implicit in some of the thinking that went into the law anyway. But the law definitely does help to contribute to that narrative where people of color are viewed as being inherently suspect or inherently criminal, and that white people are encouraged to think of themselves as this sort of, you know, besieged
group.
Yeah.
So many forces that are doing that now. It's the law is as much a reflection of that as it's a further sort of extension of it.
So, yeah, I don't know that your view is really contradictory to mine. I think it is, as you said, more complementary, that the law does reflect that larger cultural narrative. And at the end of the day, changing the law is not going to be enough to change that narrative. We're going to have to do something more serious.
Police are now much more aggressive. Probably much more important, in fact, in something in a case like this one, is not the Stand Your Ground law, but it's the knowledge now by police in every city, including here in Portland, that all you have to do is claim, "I thought he had a gun," mm-hmm. and you can shoot people. Oregon does not have a Stand Your Ground law, but the police intensified their fear in some ways out of that same narrative. It's mm-hmm. become powerful with them in their imaginings. And secondly, they see a license for killing people who seem to threaten them or they don't like, if they just have to testify that cigarette lighter, that cell phone, the iPad, all of those little things with a little shiny surface is a gun that they're holding.
Right. Or nothing at all. I mean, the most recent case of this is the officer Ron Frashauer has just been reinstated to the Portland Police Bureau. And he was fired 2 years ago after he had shot and killed an unarmed black man named Aaron Campbell. And Campbell was found to be unarmed, was, according to the police story, doing his best to comply with their instructions. And when they fired at him with a less lethal shotgun for reasons that are totally unclear, he dropped his hands from his head and started to move away, at which point Ron Frashauer fired a shot from his assault rifle and shot him in the back and killed him. And Frashauer said, well, he didn't even have something that he mistook as a gun. He said he was moving as though he might have a gun. And morally, it seems to me like there's a very important difference between shooting somebody who is actually dangerous, shooting somebody who you just think might be dangerous. But in terms of police policy, it doesn't seem to make any difference. I mean, Frashauer was fired, and the Portland Police Association took that through to arbitration, and the arbitrator just ordered him reinstated. And so the moral of that story, as far as the police are concerned, is that killing black people won't really have a consequence.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Christian Williams. We've been talking about the Trayvon Martin case, the roots of it. Recently concluded a little discussion on the significance of the Stand Your Ground law, and agreed that it has some significance, but it itself is a reflection of a set of larger tendencies, and including the fear and paranoia that so many Americans now feel. Where does that come from? Why is it that narrative gripping people? Why do they feel so frightened? Why do so many people want to get those others?
I mean, a lot of it is just simple racism. The fear that the white population has for people of color and black people in particular has been a strong element of American culture going all the way back to colonial times. I think some of how that plays out is that other insecurities, other social fears, and especially the feeling that things are changing in an unpredictable or undesirable way end up being read in this racial term, whether or not that really makes any sense. And so there's a tendency that the right has tried to capitalize on of translating the economic insecurities of middle-class people, working-class people, into xenophobia and race hatred, and the cliche about how they're taking our jobs and all that kind of stuff. Whereas, like, really what's happening is just capitalism. Because that racial fear is such a strong element, it becomes something that the right can take advantage of and push as an explanation for things that it doesn't actually connect to. And the familiar racial narrative will sometimes even block out more rational explanations about what's really happening.
You know, there's another aspect to it, to what I think happens. A good number of the people are people with actually secure incomes and fairly secure lives in some ways. There's also a sense of being predated upon in this society, that you're always a target for people wanting to take things away from you.
Well, I mean, that's how the society works. Yeah, I mean, that's a correct fear.
Yes, there's no question that we are all targets of of forces.
But it's mostly not muggers. It's mostly, your banker. Your landlord or your boss.
Your
fraudulent
hospital system or the... I mean, right. Yes, there's so many scams.
I mean, people are exploited and, for lack of a better term, robbed, every day in a totally institutionalized fashion. But that's all very abstract. It's much easier to be afraid of, some particular guy on some particular corner. So I think some of the insecurity about losing the things that you have or the things that you care about gets personified in this very odd, individualized kind of way, rather than focusing on the much larger system of criminality that just is our economy.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll agree. Part of it is that it's abstract, more abstract, and doesn't have the same somehow emotional appeal of just blaming somebody. And on the other hand, it's also because the real people who are creating all of this, the insecurity and the predation, provide the jobs in their community, and people are afraid of actually going at them. That is, they've been sort of elevated to the status of gods, where they can determine the employment levels and the wealth of a community, or make them desolate. And my sense is that that's part of that picture.
Yep.
The tremendous, and you can't go at those people. Ordinary people cheer when a company comes to town.
I mean, it's necessarily safer to attack powerless people than
yes.
to attack powerful people. And I think you're right that there's something about the tendency to view it in individual terms that not only makes it so that people want to attribute their fears and their insecurities to some individual person, but they also conceive of the remedies to their fears and insecurities as their individual action, rather than viewing it as a collective process that we can undertake together. Because we can go after powerful companies and, you know, big landlords and all the rest of it. We just can't do it individually. We have to do it together. And then I also think that there's something very American about loving success. And so there's a tendency to think that the people who are powerful deserve to be powerful, and the people who are powerless deserve to be powerless. And if somehow you feel like you're getting a raw deal, then there's a tendency for people to look at the people that they've already decided are bad people who will be the powerless people. And again, I think the racial narrative there is just right under the surface.
KBOO Radio again, Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Christian Williams, wrote Our Enemies in Blue. Christian, we have to conclude. What The Old Mole likes to do at the end of every interview, and after the sort of analytic part of why it's all happening, and it's happening for a variety of reasons, that is the racializing of fear and the paranoia that's gripping more and more people in this country, or just very briefly talk about the means of combating it, and also combating the possibilities of more armed people getting far more aggressive and feeling they have a license to go out there and actually push around others and kill the ones who in any way resist.
I mean, I think there's a really big question there. Okay, it's a easy question. It's a really big answer, which is that in order for people to not be subject to that kind of fear, they need to have their basic needs met. And so changing the nature of our society so that everybody has enough and so that we don't have the absurd levels of inequality that we do, I think is ultimately going to be the fundamental piece of relieving that kind of culture of fear.
And also to help people get to have dignified lives. Some of it is just that things are so meaningless and so weirdly complex and yet without much real pleasure and huge and sort of consumerist impulses that people are lost. And Christian Williams, thanks for talking to us today.
It's always a pleasure, Bill.